discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover Napro technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor.
Raring to go.
Oh, this is a subject that actually I don't know very much about, artificial reproductive technologies, but there are many to choose from. In my mind, I've always thought of artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization, but there are many variations on that.
Well, there are variations on it. The people who promote these like to call them assisted reproductive technology as opposed to artificial reproductive technology, but I prefer the word artificial because it's really substituting for a natural act of intercourse, for example, to achieve pregnancy. In some of these cases, they're taking the woman's egg and taking it out of her body and then putting it in a petri dish and combining it with a sperm and then letting things grow for a few days and then reimplanting it into the uterus. That's what in vitro fertilization is, or IVF.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very artificial in its approach, and so I think the term artificial reproductive technology to apply to not only this, really, but frankly, all the contraceptive things we've been talking about in abortion. I mean, it's all one big happy family out there of artificial reproductive technologies. And the field of a reproductive medicine today, all over the country and certainly all over the Western world, has adopted these as the mainstay of their approach to treatment. So just to kind of orient us is, if you have an infertility problem and you go to the local doctor for treatment, you're going to end up going into one of these directions because that's where they're going to refer you. And they think there's nothing else available. And that, of course, is not true. But so far, it has been sort of true because people don't know about the work in Napro technology. But artificial reproductive technologies are really the common everyday practice of reproductive medicine, and they're really pretty disruptive, I think.
Let's talk about infertility. Is that something that has increased over the years? I mean, why is it that we have so many different responses to it?
Well, I think it has increased, and I think there's data to show that it has increased. There has been recently a sort of another paper that came out that suggests that maybe it hasn't increased, and that argument's been going on for 20 years. But I think some of the data we have of the last 5 or 10 years show pretty convincingly that it has been on the increase. So that's number one. Number two, the various responses that we see in this artificial, it's like an alphabet soup of treatment approaches and evaluation approaches, comes out of a medical problem in a way that existed in the 60s and early 70s, in which treating infertility was always a kind of a flip of the coin approach, medically speaking. And the doctors would constantly say, well, I don't know what's causing it. I don't know why she's not getting pregnant. We would call it infertility of unknown etiology, which means unknown cause. And you see that even today, incidentally, which is really, really too bad. But anyway, back in the 70s, that was a struggle, and it was a legitimate medical struggle. I have no argument with that. I was actually trained in obstetrics and gynecology during the era when it was that sort of a struggle. But when IVF came along in 1978, the whole profession, like a bunch of lemmings going to the sea, just attached itself to in vitro fertilization as if this was the new miracle cure to infertility. The thing about it that was on the one hand appealing for these doctors was that they didn't have to know what caused infertility and they could provide a treatment. And in fact, today, they even brag about that, well, we don't have to know what's wrong with you, we just go ahead and treat you. The other side of the coin, however, it was never a very effective method of, or successful method of treating infertility. And today, it's still not a very effective or successful method in treating infertility. And if you watch television, you watch the news programs, I always like to pick on Katie Couric, because on the Today Show, frequently she'll have these women who have had sextuplets or something that results from these programs, mm-hmm. kind of making it, sort of popularizing it, you know. And it's an approach that has not improved much over these years and is actually... given the impression, I think, that this is the new technology that's really, really almost like a miracle cure to infertility, and it is absolutely not that.
You talked about the underlying causes which creates infertility in a woman. What are some of those causes? What would cause a woman to be infertile?
Well, the things that we sort of think about right away are things like she's not ovulating. The husband's sperm count might be low or might be even zero, although that's quite rare. I mean, the zero is quite rare. Mm-hmm. They may have a condition called endometriosis. They may have blocked fallopian tubes. They may have polycystic ovaries. There's different organic and hormonal conditions that actually, in many ways, we've known for a very long time. But we haven't had always the best treatments for those available. So when we started our work in the Creighton model system, one of the things we began to see right away was that the charts of the women who had infertility problems were different from the charts of women who had normal fertility. Mm. And this just bounced off of their charts. They were just so obvious. And, of course, that led us into investigating the different types of ovulation problems, the different types of underlying hormonal abnormalities, the absence of mucus, which was one of the abnormalities, and other things like endometriosis and pelvic adhesion. So all of this had to be... was actually given a huge boost because of what we saw in these charts. And I like to tell people that because there's such a negative view overall about a natural sort of approach to fertility regulation in the medical profession, this has gone completely ignored by the medical profession, unfortunately, because it's the only way you could see what we're seeing. The only way that we could see the abnormalities is to have the women chart their cycles. So when we've done that and then we started looking into the causes, it's even to this day, now we've been at this 30 years, even at this day, these charts are telling us some things we still don't know exactly what they are. And I really expect in the next 5 years, we're going to reach another major milestone in the treatment of infertility. And it's because of what these charts are telling us. And it'll lead to new ways of investigating it and new ways of treating it, which could, I think, very well be very, very successful, even more so than we currently are. And we're already more successful than the artificial programs.
So instead of investigating and treating, though, there are those who would want to handle infertility by doing artificial means.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, that's the standard. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's done almost every place. And here's the tragedy. You have an infertility problem. There's not an infertility problem that's not caused by some underlying problem. They're all caused by some underlying problem. Mm-hmm. So you go to an IVF clinic and you get treated with IVF. Really two things happen, well, three things, I suppose. One is extremely expensive.
Right.
Number two, it is very unsuccessful. It's not very successful, putting it another way. And then thirdly, whatever diseases you have going into that clinic, you're going to have walking out of it. Mm. There's absolutely no attempt to either identify them or to treat them. And to me, that pulls the rug right out from underneath some of the very best precepts of good medicine. And for some reason, all of this artificial approach, whether it's giving a teenager an oral contraceptive because she has menstrual cramps, which that oral contraceptive does not treat the menstrual cramps. It may treat some of the symptoms for a period of time, but she still has whatever's causing the menstrual cramps, to IVF, which doesn't find out what's wrong with the patient who has infertility problems. They both still have their diseases, and that goes contrary to everything we have really been taught or the whole thrust of modern medicine. And yet, the tragedy is it's been accepted by modern medicine as well as the standard of approach and treatment in these cases.
Before IVF, in vitro fertilization, there was insemination. That was something that has been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, artificial insemination has been around for a long time. It really began in the animal world with the veterinarians and their raising of different types of cattle and different types of husbandry, animal husbandry, and that sort of thing. And then it was adopted for use in humans. And it all seemed on the surface like, well, isn't this great? You take good sperm and put them in the uterus and it should solve the problem. But the bottom line is it doesn't solve the problem. The success rates are really very poor with artificial insemination. There may be a 10 or 15% overall pregnancy rate, which if you have a male who has a very low sperm count, we can get better success rates than that without artificial insemination. And what I tell my patients, because a lot of them have had artificial insemination, is I tell them that your problem is rarely ever due to a problem with insemination, which is placement of the sperm close to the cervix so it can travel to the fallopian tubes. It's hardly ever due to that. So to recommend artificial insemination as somehow the solution to something when it's not the problem to begin with, it seems to me is not going to result in very good success rates, and that's basically what's happened. And you can do with artificial insemination, you can use the husband's sperm, you can use donor sperm. I mean, they've come up with all sorts of different things. You can put the sperm right at the opening of the cervix, or you can put it high up into the uterine cavity, which is what most people do now. They use what's called intrauterine insemination. So they inject the seminal fluid right into the uterus. But the cervix and its mucus has a role to play in how the sperm prepare themselves for conception. And of course, it's a filter as well, so that there are abnormal sperm and they get filtered out through the passage through the cervical canal. So they're bypassing all of that. And as a result, to a great extent at least, their success rates really aren't very good. You talk to some people who've been doing this for years and they'll tell you even flat out they've never seen a pregnancy from it.
Wow.
Now, others, of course, have, but the percentages are very low.
Wow. And I bet it's also very expensive.
Well, it's somewhat expensive. It's not like overwhelmingly expensive, but it's kind of like they go to the doctor, and this is something the doctor can do, all right? Of course, the husband has to masturbate to get the specimen, so that's wrong right to begin with. And then they go to intrauterine insemination with very low success rates. But it's like the doctor has to do it. The doctor has to do it. It's like in all of this, the doctor has to replace it. The doctor has to be the treating arm of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
When, if we would just educate these women about their fertility and their husbands and let them have natural intercourse or natural insemination, they'll get better success rates, even if the sperm count is low. And in addition, you get a lot of hints about what the underlying problem is. Then you can investigate that with hormonal studies, ultrasound, laparoscopy, where you find out if they have endometriosis and so forth. You can treat all these things. And so out of our program, for example, they'll have higher pregnancy rates. They'll walk away with their diseases treated, identified and treated.
Mm-hmm.
And on all counts, it seems to be a better approach.
We'll return to your fertility care consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers in just a moment.
Spirit Catholic Radio presents Faith Check. Here's Greg Ewell.
Many scoff at the church's precepts and rules and can't fathom how our relationship with the church could affect our relationship with Christ. Let us remember that the high priests of Israel, due to their office, could inquire of the Lord, and recall Caiaphas' prophecy about Jesus' mission, which John 11 states was not said of his own accord, but in virtue of his being high priest that year. Our Lord upheld the legitimacy of the teaching office when he said in Matthew 23, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so practice and observe whatever they tell you," though he quickly warned not to follow their bad example. Jesus commissioned his apostles to be the leaders of his church. He told them, "As the Father sent me, so I send you. And he who hears you, hears me. And he who rejects you, rejects me." The popes and bishops of the Catholic Church succeed the apostles in their teaching office, and it is they who over the centuries have passed on the faith to us through the creeds, church councils, even scripture itself. We are called to accept the church's teachings with joy, knowing that the church is a good mother who desires our eternal happiness. And after all, who could reject his own mother? This is Greg Ewell for Faith Check.
A teaching of St. Paul from his letter to the Philippians. I even consider everything as loss because of the supreme good of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have accepted the loss of all things, and I consider them so much rubbish that I may gain Christ and be found in him, depending on faith to know him and the power of his resurrection and the sharing of his sufferings by being conformed to his death, if somehow I may attain the resurrection of the dead. We now return to Dr. Thomas Hilgers of the Pope Paul VI Institute with your fertility care consult. When we look at in vitro fertilization and all its offshoots. It seems on the surface, let's not put it to chance. Let's actually have the sperm and the egg and watch them come together and guarantee that the start of life has occurred so we can implant this in you. But there are so many drawbacks in this particular procedure, isn't there?
Well, this is in vitro fertilization, and they sometimes referred to as the test tube baby, because the egg and the sperm are taken out from the husband and the wife, and they're fertilized outside the body, and then placed at 2 or 3 days or 4 or 5 days, depending on what program they're using, into the uterus. Well, that's an approach that was popularized beginning in 1978, and then all these people who were specializing in infertility just went immediately to that. I got to tell you that the financial aspects of this plays a big role in all of this, because not only can they provide a treatment, but it's a treatment that's not covered by most insurance plans, so they know right up front they have to get people to pay right ahead of time. And so it's and women or couples with infertility are very vulnerable in this regard. So, they'll do anything that gives them some hope to have a baby, and so they end up mortgaging their home some days, and it's just a kind of a whole sort of horrible way to approach it. It's also, and this is something that you really never hear much about, but it's a highly abortive technology. For one successful in vitro fertilization, there are about 6 or 7 embryos that are lost. Again, it's a technology that's designed to create life, but the process by which it does it is through a destruction of life. It just doesn't hit well with a lot of people. And of course, on the other hand, they're not told some of these things either. So there's that ignorance thing that we talked about a couple sessions ago. But it's really sad, because very expensive, very high tech. Everything's all distant and kind of cold. I've had people come to me who've talked about how cold and distant the IVF clinics are. I've actually never been in one, so I can't personally testify one way or another to it. But I have no reason to doubt what they're saying. And it's really sad, because they sense that, they're really just a money-making operation.
Well, you mentioned that there is maybe 5 to 6 embryos that are needed. They will put the female eggs with the sperm and try for that many. Now, normally, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Hilgers, the female ovary only produces one egg every month. So how do you get more than that?
Well, first of all, you're right. Generally speaking, that's true. Once in a while, you get twin ovulations or even triplet ovulations, but it's not very common. Well, they do this by using medications that stimulate the ovary to produce multiple follicles. And they will develop 10 follicles on each ovary, so a total of 20 follicles, for example, or more sometimes. And then they go, using ultrasound and using a needle, they aspirate each one of the follicles so they can get the eggs out of the follicles. And then they use those for the in vitro procedure. And so that's how they get the, it's not at all natural, of course, to have 20 follicles or 20 eggs at one cycle. But they what is called super ovulation, or hyperstimulation of the ovaries, basically. And it's a very dangerous procedure, and you don't hear much about this either, but there's a condition called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which can be a fatal condition related specifically to the overstimulation of the ovaries.
My goodness. I mean, it that is just one particular organ that is so sensitive to cancers and just, in cystic situations with your ovaries, to mess around with that, either chemically to try to alter how it would normally function. Isn't that plain roulette with that body organ?
Well, yeah, it would certainly seem to be. And you get, getting these multiple eggs, which lead to multiple embryos, which lead to the whole process was always designed, well, not quite from the beginning, but shortly after its beginning, to insert at least 3 or 4 embryos with each attempt. Because they found out early on that if you put in more than one embryo, like 2 or 3 or 4 embryos, that it increased the chances of at least one embryo taking. So again, the whole theory, the whole principle was designed upon creating life by destroying it. They're willing to give up 2 or 3 embryos to make sure that one gets there. And of course, most of the time, it's not even one. It's a relatively small percentage of time that it's actually successful. So anyway, you've got this very artificial sort of control of fertility.
Mm-hmm.
We made a mention a few sessions ago about how the only one really who's in control in any of this is the doctor. And the doctor is a real super high-tech specialist trained specifically to do this. And frankly, he or she is the only one to understand what's going on. If you think the patient understands this, if anybody thinks that, I mean, they really don't. They understand basics maybe, but they don't. And they're not even told many times. We mentioned earlier that if they get four babies that actually take, mm-hmm. put four embryos in and they all take, well, then all of a sudden they'll come to the patient and say, oh, by the way, I don't know if I told you this, but you have to go to the perinatologist now and have a couple of these babies killed so that you only carry two because the risk of prematurity is so high we don't want to, you know, jeopardize these babies. They're willing to kill a couple of them, but they all under the auspices of saving, you know, one or two of them. It doesn't make sense.
And the term kill, I doubt, is used by the practitioner.
No, they, for some reason, you can use certain types of language which conveys the truth in all of this, but they're quick to want to change that language to soften it up so that people don't really know what's happening and aren't so much a part of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. When we have a couple, or if you know a couple that truly would love to have a baby and they're struggling and they've tried so many different ways, our hearts go out to them because they would like to create a home to welcome a life that they can nurture.
Yeah.
And so they turn to these different methods because they're trying to accomplish that. When the church teaches that these procedures are dangerous and essentially morally wrong, people rail because they feel the church is trying to control their lives and they don't appreciate the fact that they want to have a family.
Well, of course, it's sort of the same old thing all over again when Humana Vitae came out and said, well, the church doesn't understand, the church doesn't like, you know, the things that we absolutely need in order to lead a healthy life, etc. So then when Donum Vitae came out, which is the Instruction on Infertility, which was about 1987, written, incidentally, by Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now Pope Benedict XVI,
mm-hmm.
That one laid out all the dimensions of the morality, really, of all of the artificial reproductive technologies. Once again, we don't have a lot of education for Catholics on these procedures, but the church clearly sees them as immoral. So when they see that and they hear that, well, then they think, oh, there goes the church again. They're cutting off my capability, and they don't understand my situation. They're insensitive to my desires, etc. Well, the thing is that the church is not only sensitive to their desires; they care very much about the fact that they want to have a family, would like to have a family. They're only concerned about doing it the right way, because if you do it through all these wrong different directions, it can lead to a lot of regret, mm-hmm. A lot of other sort of psychological aspects of this, psychodynamic aspects of this that are not very healthy. So it's hard for these couples who are desperate to have a baby, as you described, to see that, because they're tied up with it and involved in it. With regard to that, the desire to have a baby is a very, very strong desire. You really see it a lot in the infertility population. And it's not a bad desire. It's a very good desire, and it's one that, all of us would like to see fulfilled. It's just that there's right ways to do this, and there's not right ways to do this. And that's all really the church is trying to say. There has to be an order, a sort of a moral ordering of all of these things, so that you take things in the right direction and the right perspective. And so when Donum Vitae came out, we actually held an international conference here in Omaha on that teaching, and we were probably one of the very few fertility clinics in the whole world that didn't have to change anything we were doing in order to conform to Catholic teaching, mm-hmm. which was really neat. And so the church has, and their teaching has been, you know, full force behind what we do and how we do it. And I've never been apologetic about it. And I, now that we have more data and we understand how successful it really is, we not only aren't apologetic, we now want to spread the word, because we know that we can be more successful than an IVF clinic. We can be more successful than an artificial insemination program. And in the process, the people who go through a treatment program that's geared towards finding the disease and treating it successfully come to grips with their infertility if they don't become pregnant. And have a baby if they do become pregnant. There's no program in the world that's 100% successful. Our program's as good as any, if not better than most. So,
yeah, I would think that not having to make a Sophie's choice on which of your children that has been conceived through artificial insemination will be allowed to live, as opposed to being essentially, killed.
Yeah.
They have to kill the child. And also being able to find out what's going on inside your body so that you can be healed. That's the incentive. That's what the goal should be. Don't you agree?
Well, I do agree. And I think that that's sort of the missing, one of the missing links in contemporary reproductive medicine. Mm. They're not concerned about what's wrong with them. And so if you were to say, are we ever going to find a cure to infertility, which is a legitimate question, I think, I can say almost for certain that if we continue down the artificial approach road, we'll never find a cure because it's not interested in the causes. How can it find a cure? An approach which is interested in the causes, investigates what those are, is open to possibly other things that maybe we don't know now but may come in the future that are partly the cause. And if we can find those and understand those, then the chances of finding a real cure are actually very, very good. And that's what we've been working on and working toward. And in some cases, you take, just as an example, someone who has polycystic ovarian disease, and we'll talk about this in a later time, but we have 80% success rates now. And that's not a cure, but it's getting real close. So, and other programs are not quite that good, but they're pretty good. And we're going to find a cure someday.
Well, I'm looking forward to the sessions to come when we talk about how women can be healed and how NAPRO technology is leading the way in a very humane, loving opportunity for women and men and families to grow.
Well, we've laid a lot of groundwork now in terms of what the contemporary world of medicine is doing in all of the areas of the artificial approach to reproduction. And so now we can begin to move on to looking at those conditions that we can identify, we can help heal and prove to really be of assistance to the women who suffer from these conditions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hilgers.
Great being here.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Hilgers and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers.